If you're a podcast host, listen up, this one's for you. My name is Allie Jackson. I'm the host of Finding Mr. Height, a dating and relationship podcast that I've been doing for 4 years now, sharing my positive and practical approach to dating that's built on my own life experience. And I wanted to share another experience that I've had, my secret behind monetizing my show. It's called Red Circle. And I was just telling my colleague about how much I love their platform. With Red Circle, not only am I getting a seamless hosting experience, but I also love the support I receive in ad sales. It's not just typical ad sales either. It's targeted opportunities based on my show and my life. And the platform is super simple. You just set your preferences and Red Circle matches you with sponsors that align with your show. You can vet every opportunity and their platform gives you great analytics. More recently too, my Red Circle team has brought me opportunities outside of my podcast on social media to really augment the podcast partnerships, bring them full circle. I just can't recommend them enough. If you want to give it a try, go to redcircle.com to get your free trial. That's redcircle.com for a free trial. If you're a podcast host, listen up, this one's for you. My name is Allie Jackson. I'm the host of Finding Mr. Height, a dating and relationship podcast that I've been doing for 4 years now, sharing my positive and practical approach to dating that's built on my own life experience. And I wanted to share another experience that I've had, my secret behind monetizing my show. It's called Red Circle. And I was just telling my colleague about how much I love their platform. With Red Circle, not only am I getting a seamless hosting experience, but I also love the support I receive in ad sales. It's not just typical ad sales either. It's targeted opportunities based on my show and my life. And the platform is super simple. You just set your preferences and Red Circle matches you with sponsors that align with your show. You can vet every opportunity and their platform gives you great analytics. More recently too, my Red Circle team has brought me opportunities outside of my podcast on social media to really augment the podcast partnerships, bring them full circle. I just can't recommend them enough. If you want to give it a try, go to redcircle.com to get your free trial. That's redcircle.com for a free trial.
Hello and welcome to another edition of Turned Out a Punk. I'm your host, Damian Abraham, and today on the show, they don't get too much bigger than this in Canada. Paul Langlois from the band The Tragically Hip is on the show. If you are from Canada, you know how big this is. If you are from anywhere and you know a Canadian, you probably know how big a deal this is. The Tragically Hip are the biggest band ever from Canada, and as I talk about it with Paul, it's really hard to kind of place their significance in terms of comparisons, certainly to the music I know best, which is probably music from America or the UK. So I'll just leave it at they're a band that everyone pretty much in this country has some sort of interaction with or has had some sort of interaction with in terms of the music or seeing them perform their final concert on live TV shortly before Gord Downie, rest in peace, passed away, or just hearing someone talk about this band. They are a huge band. On a personal level, years ago I wrote an article just before Gord passed away for Vice about my journey with the Tragically Hip, and I'm not going to bore you by reading it now or anything, but I'll summarize it as saying I was a fan of the Tragically Hip as a young kid, as they were sort of on this ascent. And then they became kind of the biggest band in Canada. And without knowing any of the people, just not necessarily being a fan of some of the people that were very vocal fans of the band at that point, I kind of just dismissed them and walked away. Only years later to kind of come back, not only to the music, but then to also realize from talking to people within music, from seeing the way they carry themselves, from eventually meeting Gord Downie, I realized that they're like the coolest people ever. And I don't think I'm overstating it. You're going to hear in a second when Paul starts talking, he is one of the most down-to-earth people I've ever met. He might be very well the most down-to-earth person that's ever been on this podcast, and we've had some pretty down-to-earth people that have been on this podcast over the years. A few that weren't, but, you know, for the vast majority are pretty down to earth. But Paul, I don't know, you'll hear in a second, is just unbelievably humble and unbelievably cool. And yeah, like Tragically Hip, even despite coming back to him, I didn't realize any of this punk stuff till I kind of talked to Gord, and then more so when I watched the Tragically Hip documentary, which I strongly recommend checking out if you haven't watched it. Because, as you'll hear in a second, a lot of punk stuff with this band, totally born out of punk rock. Okay, well, I'm not going to ramble on too much more because I've already talked more than I normally do on these things. Other than to say, Paul has a fantastic new solo record that just dropped last week, if you're listening to this thing, or last month, sorry, if you're listening to this thing when it came out. Smooth Rock Falls is the name of this record. It's really hard to pin down what it sounds like, other than to say it's just like a fantastic, really cool, really different, interesting kind of record. I strongly suggest you check it out. Also, if you are so inclined, I think Paul's got some dates coming up. It doesn't say so yet on thehip.com, where you can order this record and find out more information. But I did see that there is a festival in Edmonton announced that he's going to be playing later on this year. So hopefully more dates are going to be in the pipeline and you will get a chance to see Paul play live. And that's it. I'm not going to ramble on too much more. I'm very excited for you to hear this one. I do have a couple of small notes to get to. Neil Young left Canada 21, I believe. I'd say 18 on the thing, but it's 21. And the consolidated line appears after, not before. That will make sense once you get to that part of the episode. But that's it. Sit back, relax, enjoy Paul Langlois on Turned Out a Punk. Paul, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Oh, it's a pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me.
Well, this is a huge honor for me to get to talk to you because we'll talk about this later on, but it's just like, it's kind of hard to contextualize, and you probably get this all the time from everybody, but like where you and the band sit in Canadian culture. Like I used to say, like, you know, and people always go, oh, Bruce Springsteen, Bob Dylan, but I don't think that quite gets what it is. And so I just say that to say that it's a big thrill to have you on the show.
Well, thanks very much. Yeah, it's something that you know, I appreciate when, say, I'm talking to someone about it, like now, but no, I totally forget. Sometimes when I walk at the door or go downtown or something, I'm reminded because someone will come up and say something nice. It's always something really nice. And I don't reflect too much, but you know, the way it all went and the way we were able to Gord was able to do that the last tour, like, you know, it's surreal, but very much appreciated. I appreciate my life in music.
But I think that's exactly it, what you articulated right there. It's kind of that humbleness. Like I recently did a podcast with Larry Charles, who did the Bob Dylan movie with Bob Dylan, like that, you know, Masked and Anonymous, I think it's called, if I remember correctly.
Yep.
And in talking, Bob Dylan never forgets he's Bob Dylan. And Bruce Springsteen, like, I've never met him, but I get the way he carries himself. He never forgets he's Bruce Springsteen. And I think the humbleness and the ability to forget and to just be a normal person. Like I knew Gord a little bit, like we hung out and he did some vocals on our record. And so, I also worked at a video store that he used to come and rent videos at too, on the Danforth.
Oh, okay. On the Danforth?
Yeah.
I would have been there with him for sure.
Review video on the Danforth.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
And the thing that struck me then as a kid was just the humbleness of it. And I think that's the thing that, you know, I was also saying it was like Oasis in England, but like that doesn't really get it either, because what you have is that so quintessential Canadian humbleness to the band that makes it so special to, I think, Canada.
You know, that makes sense to me. Like, I'm fairly 100% sure that Oasis don't, the Gallagher brothers don't forget that they're the Gallagher brothers, which is a great thing, you know, and I love them. I find them hilarious. And, you know, same with Bob Dylan and Bruce Springsteen. I mean, they're just such been icons, you know, most of their lives. With us, you know, we're a band. That's one thing. And yeah, I mean, there is a Canadian sort of humbleness that I'm aware of too. I think it's certainly maybe requires effort for some Canadians, but didn't really ever require effort for us because we were a team, and it was just kind of like we were proud of being in the Hip, and we were proud of the Hip. But it maybe a bit different if you're an individual too. Yeah, I mean, I would take that as a compliment. We certainly have enjoyed it, and happy to remain approachable and humble, and just kind of fit in around here. I'm in Kingston, and three of us are, Gordon, Robbie too, and yeah, it's normal, and normal when you go to Toronto. You know, if I go to a hockey game or something, I might do some selfies, but you know. And the other thing I like to point out with people, like, you know, I'm sure you find the same thing. No one comes up and says bad things. They come up and say, hey, really love your music, or I really love the song, or I saw you here or there. And, you know, so it's a very rewarding experience talking to people that that like our music and our band.
Yeah, like, I think that's the, I think that's the great thing to me about what you guys do outside of the music and everything. It's also, it sets a tone for how a band can and should carry themselves in Canada. Like, if the biggest band can be that humble and be that real and approachable, then it's gotta be a top down type thing. And that's why, when you see those bands that don't carry themselves that way in Canada, and it's interesting, like, I think it sometimes it works for these bands' benefits if they deliberately try and, you know, be that tall poppy, but yep. But I think it also, you know, everyone knows it's a put on, because if the biggest band can still be fucking normal ass people and chill, then, like, why can't you, playing this 10 band Battle of the Bands bill, be a normal chill person?
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting, and there are, you know, I'm certainly not in denial about the fact that there are artist bands that don't necessarily carry themselves in that sort of humble, nice, normal kind of way. I mean, we've been friends since high school. I think that makes a difference. All from the same town, but we learn things on the way. From bands that we looked up to, certainly Rush. There are a couple of experiences, you know, we've had a few now, but early on, the first couple of times we met them, I was like, oh my God, they're the nicest guys, and so smart and conversational. And we found that, you know, we opened for the Stones, and that you mentioned, that kind of trickle down effect from the top down, we got treated beautifully. And by everybody, right down to the, you know, the stage people and everybody. I remember just us noticing it and talking about it and saying, that's really how to do it. You know, and same with our opening bands, you know, it wasn't like we were just hanging in the dressing room waiting for them to finish. We'd go watch them. And not necessarily all together. We'd all pick our little spots, but and we wanted to support them. We wanted them to have a chance, because it's just hard to break through. And the best way that we always knew was to get in front of people and build up crowds and that kind of thing. And so we just had a chance to do that. And, you know, the better it went, the more we could dive into charity and do some good and raise money. So it just, I don't know, we all had pretty solid parents and pretty solid group of friends. And so we kind of, in the early days, there was a bit of mystery about us because I think we're from Kingston and we kind of whip in and play the horseshoe, but then take off to Sudbury or wherever. And so we didn't necessarily know a lot of the bands at that time for a little while. You know, there was a few years there. But, you know, the first time we met Bare Naked Ladies, we were in England at this hotel and we look over and they're at the other table. This is like in early 90s. And one of them, probably Tyler, the drummer, stood up and said, "Hey, you want to fight?" And, you know, it's just kind of, it's pretty classic because you kind of develop these silent rivalries. And so we all just burst out laughing. It was great.
Well, I think it's so funny. And like, you know, Stephen Page was on the podcast and we talked about this, but like so many of us are drawn, particularly to, I guess, punk music. And I will ask you about punk music in a second, I promise. But
yeah,
like, I feel like because of insecurity or because not necessarily in a negative way, but like because of like the fact that we're dealing with something that is bumming us out. And you see that especially with lead singers in bands where they're like trying to fill this void, trying to fill this hole. And so as much as it's about the music, it's also about this self-gratification that comes from making this music. And it's funny you say that about the Rolling Stones, because I've definitely heard other people have less than great encounters with certain members of the Rolling Stones over the years as well.
Right.
And where it really did come across like, holy shit, how is this person still insecure? And that's the thing, is I never got the sense that you guys were insecure as people, like about who you were fundamentally. And so I think like I was talking to someone today, like it's crazy to think about you guys and Guns N' Roses coming out at the same time, like Appetite for Destruction and like, and obviously they're like a stripped down example, like the glam rock stuff that was going on in Toronto even at that point, and the teased hair and the eyeliner and this sort of like edifice kind of presentation. Like you guys never did any of that. Like you guys have always just looked like who you guys seemingly were.
Yeah, that's it was an interesting time for us because our music was, you know, it was rock and roll, but certainly different style of presentation. I mean, we had Gord. That was big. You know, he's in clubs, people be like, what is with this guy? Who is he? And he was mostly a dancer, really. And he ended up getting sort of a bit, I don't mean crazy in a bad way, crazier, and just kind of, you know, developed quite a personality, but he was really just a dancer. But the crowd noticed. You know, play Thursday, Friday, Saturday, it's full by Saturday because people are just like, you got to go see this guy, and the band's tight. And, you know, so we were just in our own worlds. You know, we knew that Guns N' Roses, for that matter, Motley Crue, were very different from us. And we weren't really shooting for anything but to be ourselves and keep writing. Writing songs was the main thing. We knew we were, you know, a live band, and we felt like we were tight. Speaking of the Clash or someone like that, you know, it's we took pride in that, but we needed to keep writing, and so that was a big goal. And yeah, we were just different from, and then Nirvana comes along, you know, and all that happened. And we just kind of managed to, you know, float in the middle and just do our thing. And there wasn't any weird pressure or anything, but we were aware that we were different.
even though the time where you start, I guess, going to Toronto, it's like kind of Handsome Ned's Queen Street West, right? Like it's everyone's like kind of doing the rockabilly thing, or like Bobcats, Razorbacks. Like there was like and you guys, once again, like it's a band that you can't pin down. Like, what do the Tragically Hip sound like? It's like, they sound like the Tragically Hip. Like there's not like you guys weren't a rockabilly band at the time when everyone in Toronto seemingly was.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And, you know, we were influenced in the early days by the bands that would come through Kingston. I mean, certainly we weren't all together then, but, you know, we all saw our fair share of shows. Teenage Head was big influence. You know, it was like, wow, they're not doing anything but playing their songs, you know, punky for sure. And rockabilly a little bit, but, they just seem to have their own sound. And, that was a big goal of ours, is just to sound like ourselves. So we never attempted to sound like anybody. And that's no offense to that, because some people, when they're recording, would say, hey, put on that Floyd record and, you know, let's get something, those kinds of sounds. And we were really against that. We just came in and played what we played and just tried to compliment the song serve the song. So, but yeah, there are a lot of bands. But speaking of the Razorbacks, Tony Kenny was in a band called Wise Guys in Kingston, and they were rockabilly as well. They were super cool, not as acoustic-y as Razorbacks, who were great too, but the Wise Guys just had this swagger, three-piece, and dressed up in cool, you know, not cowboy uniforms, but the ornate kind of stuff. And a really great band. They played pretty regularly at a hotel here. So, you know, I would think they would have been an influence too. It's just like watching bands live really got into all of our heads that's the way to go. We're a live band. Let's do that.
I love the Razorbacks. Like, I think they're one of those bands that, you know, and yeah, in Canada, there's no second act, right? Like, it feels like, barring you guys and Blue Rodeo and bands that kind of perennially have been part of the culture, like there's so many great bands that are completely forgotten about, but the Razorbacks, they had like a CBC TV special at one point, right? Like they were big.
Yeah. Yeah. And we knew, Tony Kenny because, of the Wise Guys, and, you know, we didn't know him well or anything, but we certainly followed him. Yeah, they did great. There's so many bands like that. You're right. That just kind of, you know, made a really good mark, but didn't necessarily come perennial, as you say, like us or Blue Rodeo. But, you know, plenty of bands out there, and why not support them? In the early days of any band, you're kind of like, we're the best, and I hate those guys. And gradually you get over that. And we did fairly quickly, which is good.
Well, speaking of bands that are somehow crazily underrated, was Teenage Head your first exposure to punk?
I'm just trying to think of early Kingston bands. Probably. Like, live, yep. Certainly The Clash were a big influence on the band itself. Sex Pistols, too. You know, because those records came out just as we were, well, I guess we hadn't started yet, but teenagers. And it was just like, oh my God, this is so rock. And Never Mind the Bollocks it was just like, I'd never heard anything like it. And The Clash, it was like, yeah, they're punk, but they're so tight. You know, it's just, and not just me. I mean, the other guys were even bigger fans. Gord Sinclair was massive Clash fan. I think he got on stage once in Toronto at, I don't know if it was at the CNE or where it was, but he worked his way onto the stage, got kicked off, you know, thrown off.
That's awesome.
Yeah, pretty cool. So, yeah, I mean, always followed it, but those would be the early examples. But Teenage Head, probably the first punk band. I'm trying to think. I know there was another punk band coming through Kingston, but...
Well, did the Demics or the Diodes come through?
Not that I know of or that I saw. DOA was, you know, that was another band we were aware of. I never got to see them. Yeah, we're certainly aware. But Teenage Head in and around here in Ontario, they were the top of the heap.
It's interesting because like it's almost like Liverpool in a lot of ways. I think it wasn't until I started doing the research that I started putting the pieces together about how many bands came out of Kingston. But like the same way people talk about Liverpool as being like the curse of the Beatles in a lot of ways, is there's not a lot of bands that get brought up in significance in the same way that the Beatles do. Or they're almost mm-hmm. overshadowed by who the Beatles. I find Tragically Hip in Kingston, it kind of functions that same sort of way. And like when I was a kid, there was Fans of Bad Production. It was a record label out of Kingston. But there weren't a lot of Kingston punk bands. And there was always like kind of a weird mystery to me that there's so many punk bands from around all these parts of Southern Ontario, but there weren't from Kingston. And then I started doing research and saw the documentary and realized, oh, there is this completely unrecorded history of punk rock from Kingston.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, I mean, Huey Dillon is a good example. I mean, but he was living in Toronto when the hit Stones. But he was playing in bands around here. I should
the Rattlers, know. Right? I think is one of
the them. The Rattlers. Yeah, I was just trying to think of that. The Rattlers. And he and I and Gord Downey were all in grade 11, 12, 13 together. We're all friends. And there he went. And, and we remained in touch. He moved to Toronto and did the full on, punk scene and did very well. Yeah, I mean, there's a few people in Kingston that the drummer for 13 Engines, you know, and they had something going there for a good while. Grant Etche, his name is, and he was a friend too. He gave me my nickname actually, which was Rockabilly when he gave it. It's rock now, but he called me Rockabilly because the hair was a little that way. Anyway, he ended up drumming for 13 Engines for years. And it was a good scene. There were a good couple of bars that ran music. So it was a good stop between Montreal and Toronto, or Ottawa and Toronto. And these bars did well. And they were, you know, recording acts, but a lot of local acts too, trying their thing.
Yeah, we're actually playing in Kingston on Friday. But for years, it wasn't a stop for bands, I feel like. And now it's become a stop again. It's interesting how
again
places kind of, it happens to places like that.
Yeah. Well, the bar, it kind of stopped happening here when the Manor closed. And that was the bar that we played a lot. It was another bar called Commodore. And then, you know, the Toucan, what is now the Toucan, used to be the Terrapin, but there was just kind of it slowed down and it stopped being so much of a stop. I think it's turned around. A lot of bands coming through now. K-Rock Center, which is not what it's called anymore, but the arena that was put downtown was great for a while. And a lot of shows coming through, but not many at all anymore. Don't know why. I think a lot of times it's just like who's running it, what bands are thinking. Because it's certainly a stop that makes sense for any band. Are you guys playing here on Friday?
We're playing here on Friday.
Is it a stop or is it coming down to play and go back?
No, uh-huh. we're it's our first day of our tour. We're going to England and we're doing a whole set of new material for this 4.5 hour long song we have.
Oh, wow.
We're not going to play the whole 4.5 hours. We're doing like a truncated version of, but yeah, it's our big sort of finale for our Zodiac thing that we've done for the last 20 years.
Oh yeah. 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 That's cool. I know about that.
That's crazy. It's interesting because like in the documentary and then also subsequently just kind of like digging in and researching that Tragically Hip's almost like a super group of two punk cover bands, both weirdly into Teenage Head. Not weirdly, because they're an amazing band, but it's like the Rick and the Rodents and then the Slinks.
They're both cool bands. Rick and the Rodents, there was some kind of mystery about them, and they were a bit older than us, right? Robbie and Gord Singer are 2 years older than Gord Downie and I, who are 2 years older than Johnny. And the Rodents came first, and they did end up shortening it to the Rodents. And the Slinks are odd, good band though, kind of punky too. And that was for Gord's first gig when he first got to our high school, and it was pretty obvious he was someone to look out for. So yeah, you're right. I forgot about that.
And then there's also Pressure Drop, which is like the pre-Mahones band too.
Right. I don't forget about them. Well, there was Filters.
Yeah, then they became Filters, I think, with the Slinks, right? And then
Because the Filters kind of combined Gord Downie as a singer and Robbie as a guitar player. Robbie coming from the Rodents, Gord from the Slinks, with Finney McConnell, who started and continues to crazily tour the world. He doesn't stop. And I grew up with him since grade four. And you're not even supposed to be able to play guitar when you're nine, but he played electric guitar, and I was like, wow. Anyway, there were a lot of kind of musical connections down here. And but it sometimes there's just something in the water, or you see somebody doing something cool and you want to do it too. There's a lot of that, I think.
Yeah, it's interesting how it clusters like that at times. Like the fact that like Johnny Marr, Billy Duffy, and Vinnie Riley were all friends and hung out together, you know, and like the fact that like all you guys are kind of in the same classes or in the same generation of kids in this high school, and like, you know, from the Mahones to the Headstones to the Tragically Hip to 13 Engines, like those are ginormous bands. In well, certainly in different scales, but all very important bands, and all kind of coming out of the same sort of group of people, that peer group.
It's cool. And I would say I was the last one in. I mean, I didn't really play guitar in high school. Well, I didn't. And I didn't even think I ever would. I just was kind of like, oh, that's cool. Your band's cool. I'd go to shows. And then I just started playing. And then the hip asked me to join. Like, it's pretty, it's like, okay, it's your first band. And I had plenty of other musicians that didn't catch that break. I'm not denigrating what I did. I'm just saying it was a huge break that I was able to play with these guys and get along and be on a similar wavelength as far as wanting to write, and I chiseled out my role kind of thing. So I'm not saying I didn't do that, but it's a bit of a stroke of luck to have this be my first band.
That's your humbleness coming through again. That's that we were talking about earlier. But I also found like this weird mention of Gord and you going on a trip around Nova Scotia, and Gord coming back and saying that you had written some amazing songs and were a really good songwriter too. I think someone from the Slinks.
Well, Gordon and I did do a trip to PEI, hitchhiked out there, because he had an aunt and uncle there, and I did too. And we had lost this opportunity of a job. It was actually at McMaster, between grade 12 and 13. And the job fell through last minute. So we're like, well, what the fuck? We'll hitchhike at the PEI and see what happens. But I wasn't playing guitar then. Gord was singing with the Slags, but they must have been on an extended break. So I'm not sure.
Maybe it didn't make reference to you playing guitar, but that you had written some songs and that you should write more songs or something. Anyway, this is like a very obscure reference from, I guess, 1982, I guess, was when this happened.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. It would have been 82. Yeah. Maybe. I mean, I knew I could sing at that point. And Gordon and I had messed around, but like with words and stuff. So I don't really know. I don't know. I know we were quite competitive. I kind of take credit for his lyrics because I won the English award and he came second and he was really pissed. So he decided to become a poet and basically squished me like a small bug.
It's all about that fragile ego that lead singers have, right? Like, so the whole thing's motivated by revenge for this English prize.
Yeah. Well, it's funny when we were talking earlier about, you know, people being nice all the time. It wasn't necessarily the case with Gord. Like, we'd go into a bar after the show, or we're in the bar we're playing after the show. And people, like, not as a general rule, but more so than anyone I've ever seen, just wanted to kind of take him down a peg and say something that, I mean, he's a very sensitive person, as I'm sure you noticed and discovered. But especially sensitive if it's kind of a negativity. He was. So he didn't really, he was worried if we went into a bar after a show, like a separate bar. He was worried. So, I mean, we all suck together anyway. But it would be true that, you know, I'd just be like, I can't believe it. I just came up and said that. Or that girl. So anyway, but yeah, I mean, it's can be a tough life being, or a tough little go being a lead singer, depending on what kind of vibe you give off. And sometimes I think Gord's vibe was mistaken for something other than it was, which was really just a bit of shyness, I think.
I think it's also, like, you know, and this is certainly my own experience, you construct your own narratives around bands. And you know, now that I'm in a band, you realize how much baggage people bring to your band, you know, and how upset people get when you change your sound, quote unquote, or that you do something. And it's because people take it so personally, and it's because of these narratives that they've constructed around, completely independent of the band. And I feel like that's definitely something that happened with the Tragically Hip becoming as big as you guys became. Like, I as a fan of the band, and then to watch it become so big at the same time as I'm dealing with my own insecurity of being like a 14-year-old kid trying to find my way in the world. And then all of a sudden my friends who liked punk for a minute with me all were just like, no, fuck this. We're just like only about the Hip now. And no other bands but the Hip. And so I was like, okay, well, the Hip are the villains then, because like they're the big band now and they're hugely popular and they're stealing all my friends away. Only years later to realize, oh, that's just my own bullshit. Like, these are real people that haven't, like, you know, years later meeting you guys, like years talking to you now, you guys were you guys in a way that very few bands are able to hold on to. Even my own little experience, a tiny little dose of what you guys experienced, it went to my head and affected me in a profound way. So yeah, like I bring this all back to say, like, all these people that just are carrying this baggage and coming up to you guys and unloading. And of course it's the lead singer is the one who's going to get it, because that's always for sure the mascot of the band.
Of course. And singer is the person singing, and everyone, yeah, as you say, the mascot too. Like, it's not the band I hate, it's the fans.
Which I fucked up. Gordon and I went out for lunch one day, and I thought I was like the genius who had, I thought there's no way Gord's ever heard this. So I'm like, yeah, it's just like that Sloan song. It's not the band I hate. It's the fans. And the look, I could see light for me drain from his eyes at that moment. And only years later realized, like, you fucking idiot. Like, how many times has this poor guy had to hear some idiot think they're the first person to point it out? And it's hilarious because, like, you know, being friends with Chris and stuff, and Chris being like, yeah, like, I say it's about Consolidated in the line before that. Like, it has obviously nothing to do with them, but it did, you know, and now to say it to you and probably watch the respect for me drain from your eyes very quickly, but, like, it was the case where the people that liked you had nothing to do with who the band is. And, like, yeah, I don't know. I have a much better understanding for it now, having been in a band for 20 years, than obviously I did as, like, a 15-year-old kid. But now I look at what you guys did and how you weathered that time and all the cool shit you guys started to do with, like, Another Roadside Attraction and bringing out these smaller bands and backing those bands. Like, once again, it's like the gold standard of what I would hope I would be able to do if I was ever in that position. And that's the thing that, like, yeah, like, it's like the folly of youth going back and being like, holy shit, like, did you not understand at all?
Well, I mean, you know, it's I think I would have been the same. There was a period of time where it was very, you know, very male audience. You know, Mosh Pit was starting. It was beginning to get kind of violent. You know, was it like, you know, No One's a Sinking, Blow It High Dough. It was kind of like, you know, and then even with the next record, you know, Locked in the Trunk, 50 Mission. So there's a lot of banging out there, and it was bothering certainly Gore, but all of us just like, geez, like, the girls are getting killed out there. Like, just, you know, or the small people anyway. And so it was intentional, really, because it was getting dangerous, and we didn't want to have that. So gradually, and we also had a need to change and not be the same every time. And so then it started to be, you know, with Grace 2 and Day for Night, and, you know, and then eventually leading into, you know, Ahead by a Century, where it was kind of like, okay, well, even before that, We Kings, like, little, we were starting to allow ourselves to just kind of be all sorts of things. But we didn't, we were trying to escape that a little bit. And, you know, it's kind of true. Hip fans then were pretty, like, not aggressive about it, but a little bit aggressive. Like, as you said, it's all about the hip now. And, you know, we played a Canada Day at Molson Park, and we had motel rooms sort of behind it, and we had played, we headlined, and this is like 1990 or whenever it was early, and I was in the motel room, like, and everyone's playing the hip, like, I didn't want to walk down the hall. I didn't know what a fan was even. And so, like, I just remember being in the room and being like, fuck, we got to get out of here. Like, this is, I didn't feel threatened, but it was just kind of like, it's hip everywhere. Like, what if I happen to need to go to the Coke machine or something? You know, it was just, but yeah, so I mean, I understand that the Sloan song is sort of an accident, but it does pretty much describe what our fans were like in, say, 1989.
Well, it's also this thing that I realized eventually, like, when you become popular in a band, it's not like everyone suddenly becomes cool and thinks like you do in your band. It just means that you've found a way to speak to people on a greater level than you ever expected. Like then, and so I say this, like when you guys were so big that everybody liked you. So of course there was going to be like, I only now realize like, of course assholes would like this band because everyone liked this band, like cool people, everybody. Like it was just like, it's weird now. Cause I realized that was the ascent of what was kind of happening. And like, you know, you brought up Rush and there were certainly, but like Neil Young left when he was 18, like no diss on Neil Young. Like I love his music and everything, but he was gone at 18. And like, and even Rush, like that first record's unbelievable. And like, obviously 2112 is a classic for what it is. And, but I feel like there was them kind of like making their music universal. I don't feel like the Tragically Hip ever did that. I think it became universal, or the universe kind of, or Canada came to you guys. Like it wasn't like, and I think that's why places never, like America never gets it, because it's not for America, because it wasn't ever streamlined. Like Rush did it to make it acceptable for America, or Bryan Adams did it. Like it's for everybody, but like it's for us here, and it makes sense for this country in the way, like, and that's why it's part of the identity, I think.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, but you know, I would say that came later. Say Bob Cajun later. But I don't know if Bob Cajun started it, but you know, there was certainly Canadian references all the time, but Bob Cajun's a little more obvious. I really like that song and the lyrics, but a little more kind of, oh, what the hell is Bob Cajun? You know, and someone in Arizona is going to be like, what? Bob Cajun? Whereas the Canadian reaction was quite different. And then I think just gradually it's kind of kept pouring on. I mean, we honestly were a bit surprised that we didn't get bigger in the States, but it was just so obvious. All we had was word of mouth. I mean, we had radio in San Francisco, in Dallas, in Chicago, Boston. Well, we played a bunch of bigger venues there because it was all kind of very radio based. Unlike today, I would say, but very, you got a hit or you don't. And we had, you know, songs that bubbled under and did okay. And we toured there relentlessly. But the word of mouth kind of, it's almost like, well, the bigger we got in Canada, you know, now we're moving into from theaters to arenas, the more Canadians show up in Minneapolis or anywhere, everywhere, LA. Before that, you know, a smattering maybe that had heard of us and kind of, oh yeah, no, I'm a hip fan kind of thing. But, and then it's like Newfie Night at the Horseshoe, you know, it's kind of like, okay, you can go and, you know, have fun, but you're not one of them. You're not in the in crowd. And so the Canadians kind of became the in crowd in London, England, you know, wherever we went. This is later, you know, from Phantom Power on, that began to change, which is fine. Like, you know, we loved it. We weren't necessarily flag wavers, but it was, we had a lot of support. But I think it kind of, not turn off, but you know, you're just not really part of the club. So yeah, no, good band, but I don't know that I'll go next time. I don't know.
Like that's the thing. It's also, oh, sorry, let me cut you off.
Just thinking out loud. Yeah.
I think the thing is with you guys too, like there's not like it's not flag waving. It's not like a nationalistic thing. And I say this, like, it's not like, cause you know, like Canada is on Indigenous people's land, like there's like a lot of baggage that before you start waving that flag, but it doesn't have to be that kind of flag waving because it just is what it is. Like there's that lack of pretension, And I think that's the thing that, you know, like I've been racking my brain recently, like what is Canadian culture and what defines Canadian culture in the face of American culture? And like American culture is very much geared towards selling it, right? Like it's a product. And then you look at European culture, and there's this sort of European culture where it's like, there's a highfalutin culture to it. And there's these bands that like, they're respected, but no one actually likes them because they're just, you know, it's art and that's why it exists. And I think Canadian culture is a mixing of the two, where it is populist at the same time as it's pretentious, and it has this sort of like higher aspiration to it at the same time as it's trying to be for the people. And that's just what we do. And I think that's what our music is. And I think that's like, it makes so much sense that you guys are the next step after Teenage Head, because I think that's what Teenage Head was. And like, I love the Vile Tones. Vile Tones are one of my favorite bands of all time, but Vile Tones were definitely Stephen Leckie, rest in peace, looking to England or looking and kind of saying like, okay, what's our version of this? Whereas Teenage Head, like you said, they were just a bunch of dudes from Hamilton that would be doing this if no one was paying attention, or if everyone was paying attention. As much as, you know, Frankie, rest in peace, put on the makeup and danced and put on a show, but he would be doing that if no one was watching. And I saw him do it when no one was watching, because there was very few people at those shows, sadly, in some periods of Teenage Head.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. They had classic songs. And
amazing.
And I think you're right. They'd be doing it no matter what. And, you know, we even reminded ourselves of them. You know, we played Bannisters in Hamilton. Teenage Head weren't that active anymore at that point in the early days, and there was no one there. Soundman went downstairs, so the soundman left. So there's just five of us on stage, and we did it anyway. We had these songs, and we're gonna play them. And so that did rub off on us. That's how it appeared. These guys just wrote a bunch of songs, you know, rockabilly kind of punky songs and catchy. And they're just going to play them no matter what. And there was something cool about that we all liked.
Yeah, there's something like they predate the Ramones, like in their original inception with Frankie on drums, right? Like they play their first show before the Ramones play their first show. So here's like North America is one of their first punk bands, but like they would never say it. Like no one says it. Like it's just, they were this band that had these great songs, and it's completely unpretentious. And as much as there should be a lot more fanfare around it, they never felt like they were bitter that there wasn't.
Yeah. That's certainly the vibe that I got. It just seemed like, wow, why wouldn't you? Rockabilly gave off that as well. That kind of like, this is just what we do. So, you know, kind of dance music almost. So, yeah, very, very cool. And I would say very influential.
What kind of music were you making before you decided, when you're thinking about moving to Nashville to become a songwriter? Like, what kind of songs were you kind of trying to write?
Well, I was kind of like, my voice was coming out kind of country, just at the way, like kind of nasally. You know, I was listening to Dylan and John Prine would be probably the two big ones. I would have been eaten alive down there, but I wasn't overly satisfied around here. So I just thought, well, and I'd hitchhiked before, why don't I go try it? And Gord didn't like that. So he asked the other guys to ask me to join the band. And so I did. I already liked them. And I thought they were going to do really well. So I said, okay, and abandoned that idea. I still like rock and roll and kind of stuff, but it was just, I had an acoustic guitar and I was kind of learning, and, you know, really it was Bob Dylan, John Prine, the Beatles, and just kind of like, then I was writing, trying to write songs, and they were coming out more country than I intended. So that's why I thought of Nashville.
Were you at that first hip show, or were you still in Montreal at that time? Like the
Very first hip show?
Yeah.
I was not.
It's so weird that General Idea had videos playing. Like it looks more like an art show. There's that flash of the flyer in the documentary, and I'm like, oh, yeah. They got like a bunch of art films playing as well. And
yeah, that was a Kingston Artists Association, and Robbie was very artsy, did fine arts, and so it was their like final year class kind of party. So it was all artists, and Robbie and Two Gourds and Johnny, the four of them played. Interesting set. I was around. I was probably, I don't know what I was doing. I was probably either bartending or driving a cab. But no, I missed the first show. I went to a lot of them. Gord would always put me on the list, especially when I was driving a cab for about a year. So I could just stop in and I'd be on the list. Yeah, they had some good early days.
Was there any crossover between you and Davis Manning in the band, or is it?
No, not in the band. We knew each other well, and may he rest in peace.
Yeah, absolutely. Sorry.
He was great. Like, he was a great songwriter. Didn't write anything with the hip, but he had his own songs. Like on acoustic guitar. He played sax with the band, and he was cool old cat at the time. He was 40, they were 20. And it was cool, kind of hippish vibe, having this cool cat Davis playing sax. But he was wanting to, they were all in school at Queens, and Johnny's still in high school. And Davis wanted it to move faster than it was moving. So he ended up leaving Kingston. And then they went a few months, just the four of them again. And I don't think it was going excellently, but and then I was moving. Gord didn't love it, so it was all just a matter of timing when they asked me to join. And but I love Davis; he was great. And I was good friends with all of them, including Davis.
Was there ever thought about bringing the sax back into the fold at any point in the band?
Not from any of us. I think once the idea of me joining was accepted, went out and played with them once, and wasn't really an audition. I think I was already in, but two guitars became appealing to everybody, just slightly more rock vibe. We toyed with it over the years, the idea of horn sections, that kind of thing, but never really happened. Could be my fault, I'm sort of fairly protective of my role once I lost the new guy label. But it wouldn't necessarily be my fault. It wasn't like anyone was pushing hard to do it, even though everyone's a Stones fan, and the horns are a big part of the Stones a lot of times. We wanted to keep it simple at least long enough so that we had an identity, a sonic identity. And then once we had one, it was just like, okay, why change it? Why do we need to? I mean, we toured with a couple of people a couple of times, but if the record needed more, certainly with Jim Bryson, we needed him for to do We're Not the Same. And he was great. But it just kind of, we got pretty used to just five of us, and You know, that includes used to not having weirdness, like just, you know, as you know, making a record is much more difficult than touring. I mean, everyone's getting along when you're touring. You got the songs. You're already there. You just got to play them. When you're making a record, you got to talk about them and defend your ideas. And so it's much harder on a group making records. And they were kind of marathons. But we'd get through them, and then the tour was great.
Yeah, like the sax sounds awesome on some of those old songs, and it's kind of got like a punky kind of X-ray Spexy Saints record kind of vibe to it too with the sax. And I'm like, oh yeah, it's interesting to think of the hip songs with, like, not all of them obviously, but some of them, like how a sax would have worked into those songs.
Yeah, I think it could have worked well. I mean, I saw them a lot with Davis, and it was cool. You know, I like watching Davis. I like the sound he brought. And yeah, it's different through sax and anything. And it's very different, and it's cool. Kind of brings you back, like, you know, David Bowie or something, just where in the 70s, and just kind of where horns played a big kind of role in really cool, heavy songs. But we just kind of, we just stuck to the simple things in general, and plug it and play kind of attitude.
When you guys start playing, like when you join the band, you guys are playing. Were you guys playing with Guyana Kool-Aid at all?
Yes. Oh my God! It took me a second because I thought you said Diana, so I was like, Diana who? Guyana Kool-Aid. Yes, we played with them.
They also seem to be
on the same bill a couple of times when they were all Queens, and who was Gordon Robbie, who graduated, maybe Gord Downey was in fourth year or something. But anyway, yeah, a couple of times. Yeah, we know those guys.
It's funny because they're also, like, I only know the single, but the single is like total Teenage Head Worship too.
Oh, really?
Yeah, like real heavy on one side, at least. The other side's a little weirder, but the one side, like, you can totally hear that sort of like Gord Lewis, Frankie Venom style of, you know, interplay with the guitar and the vocal and stuff. And it's,
that doesn't surprise me. Yeah. Cause I do remember that they were kind of, they sounded that way. I never heard anything they recorded, but saw them live a couple times. There's another band, the Raging Groovies. But I don't know that they ever recorded.
I don't know if I've ever heard of the Raging Groovies, no.
Kind of our main rivals in the early days. Queens guys. No.
What were they? What was their sound? What were they? Did they kind of sound like?
Well, at the time, we're younger. We felt like their sound was becoming like ours. You know, similar, because we were doing this early 60s unknown covers. And they started doing that. So, the Guyana Kool-Aid guys kept going a bit after that scene.
I think they became Pariah.
Oh, that's right. Pariahs.
I always associate you guys with this period where my dad moved to... Well, not. I guess this is after your period of being on Queen Street West, but I think I was kind of like in the shadows of, I kind of look at, and I think someone else described it as this, but the Kingston Mafia period of downtown Toronto, where you had Peter Crook, X-Ray, rest in peace, and Dan Aykroyd as this.
Oh, that's so, like, funny. Yeah. Sorry, keep going.
No, well, they had like Crooks, they had X-Rays in the spec, and what was the thing above X-Rays called again? Ultrasound?
Yeah, ultrasound.
And then they had, of course, the Horseshoe, but they had all these bars, and they were kind of, as I say, I was just a little bit after the fact, but my dad's girlfriend at the time kind of rolled with it, with that crew. And so there was like this sort of, the Kingston Mafia was, I think, what it was introduced to me as.
Mm-hmm. Forgot about that. I didn't know where you were going with that. But yeah, I mean, we knew all those guys. quite well. And yeah, they had it going there. Kenny Sprackman was at the Horseshoe with X-Ray. And then, yeah, X-Ray opened his spot. And yeah, Peter Crook was always involved. Well, we only ever played the Horseshoe. But went to X-Rays. Matter of fact, Gord Downey and I brought Universal guys to see the head at Trace. We knew they were a great band at the time, and but an unsigned band. And yeah, they got signed. I don't know if it was directly because of that, but Hugh, I remember, was very, very grateful. He's like, "You brought record company guys." And I was like, "Yeah, well, we were meeting up with them anyway." And that was at Ultrasound, I think, the place upstairs, if memory serves.
We used to go and spend like the whole afternoon in X-Rays, like just playing shuffleboard when I was like a kid. And they had the best mixed Pepsi ever. Like the Pepsi out of their fountain to this day. I don't know what they did with it. Extra sugar or something, but it was so good.
Oh, really? Yeah, and I saw X-Ray soon before he passed away. Man, he rest in peace.
Absolutely.
My dad was just three doors. This is like 3 years ago. And my dad was in the hospital just for a couple of days. And X-Ray was three rooms beside. And I just happened to see him. And I go into his hospital room. He was having problems, ulcer or something like that. And we were, like, this is 5 or 6 years after Gore died. And he's like, "What are you guys doing anyway?" And I said, "What?" He's, "Well, you keep putting out these box sets and all this stuff. Why don't you just stop? Just stop doing that."
he was very outspoken in my run-ins with him over the years and stuff. I used to hang out at the Horseshoe because I used to do a radio show with Jeff Cohen. So I could go in there underage as long as I promised not to go out on the floor and watch bands. I don't think I saw you guys there. I saw the Stones there, but I saw you guys at Lee's Palace do like a special secret show one time.
Oh,
that was fucking crazy packed.
Yeah, I remember that show. I think that's the only time we played Lee's, or maybe we did earlier when we were unknown.
Nirvana played Lee's, I remember, and I find it so interesting that you and Nirvana played that show together, that infamous show together that one time, because very different bands in a lot of ways, but I feel like there's like this sort of like weird similarity between the two, because like both you guys came from a punk rock kind of sensibility. And I think like what happened with Nirvana and everything, ultimately what happened to Kurt Cobain, there's a lot going on there, but I think part of it was also just sort of like trying to navigate this success, which had come on. And, you know, he talked about it, like these terrible people that he would have hated now all of a sudden liking his band and, you know, feeling trapped in that. And I'm projecting, I guess, when I say this, but I could totally see what that would feel like. In the same way, I think you guys kind of, what you describe, are going through that too a little bit up here with like the fan base changing. But just the way you guys were able to weather that storm, it's just like a marked contrast. And the fact that you had this point early on in both of your careers where you're weirdly on a bill together.
Yeah, they were heavy. I went up to see them. I'm not sure if anyone else, the dressing room is downstairs. One thing I didn't notice is we did our sound check, and Gord Downey pointed this out. Kurt was, in hindsight, asleep on a table while we did our sound check, which I don't remember noticing. But then I went up to see them, and they were like heavy, heavy, heavy. Way heavier than I expected, and way heavier than any band we had been on a bill with. And it was kind of just a confusion. We were both supposed to play. So it was a misbooking. No one opening for either, but just, yeah, okay, he couldn't both play. And yep, so no interaction. Don't know if they stuck around for us. My memory is that we went on second because I remember going up on stage and coming back down. And these guys are, you know, they could hear them down there too. These guys are pretty heavy. Anyway, yeah, interesting. And we all related to him and to them. You know, gutted when he died. And, you know, it all came so quickly for them, you know. And, you know, his environment, I think, was semi-stable. But we're all from very stable environments, which I think helps anyone deal with things. But it also happened kind of almost overnight for them and in a huge global way. So way different than what we went through. Way tougher to handle. So I've always felt for him and always loved their music.
Yeah, like, and like fundamentally different bands, but I think there'd be...
Yeah.
Like, I like to think there was part of him that would have liked the opportunity to do like another Roadside Attraction. And like, you kind of see like by the bands they would bring out where they bring out the Melvins and
yeah.
And I'm intrigued to hear what your thoughts are. Cause I've heard from bands that opening for the Hip is a hard slot to have because obviously people are there to see you guys versus something like another Roadside Attraction where you're kind of building a festival. So you're setting the whole tone for the whole day in a way, which I think probably serves all those artists better than maybe a direct opening slot would.
Yeah, I think so too. Yeah, it was, you know, the odd time a band would get hipped, you know, and so, you know, people chanting, which, you know, we didn't like, and, you know, you got this opening band and everyone's calling for the Hip to come out. So all these little subtle things we could do. I mean, that wasn't the reason we did Roadside, but our intentions were to showcase lesser known bands. And our intentions were to put ourselves up against the wall, having to go on After Midnight Oil or Ziggy Marley, who had about 15 people on stage and kids and dancing. And, you know, it's so we just put ourselves in that position going after Sheryl Crow. Even, I mean, it was, you had to be, have your wits about you. And we intentionally put ourselves in that position that we got this, we can do it. And, you know, we had the fans, but we needed to play well. And so that whole thing was a, you know, it's a highlight all 3 years we did it. I think it's a highlight for all of us. We all look at it as an achievement because it was like 10 weddings, you know, it was just constant, you know, hosting and making sure everyone's and that it's all going well. So, yeah, really happy we did that.
I've heard the like Gord's lyric change at the Saturday Night Live performance. He told me it was because he was trying to remember something and then flubbed the line. But then recently I've seen on TikTok people saying it was because you guys were stoned on weed. I don't know where that quote is attributed to, but I've seen some TikToks about it. Was there weed smoke backstage at SNL? Maybe not by yourself. Don't have to incriminate yourself. And if so, who procures the weed for people at SNL?
Oh, we would have procured that for ourselves. Because I think we were there for a couple of days, day before at least. Yeah, so we smoked one right before we went on. And I think it's a combination of that, and he honestly was trying to remember to his nephew, who was like about 7 or something, had asked him to wave to him or do something, and that's what he was trying to do. So it just came out. And he, you know, sang that. He said, "I'm tragically hip," pretty much every time the rest of our career. And so I would say it's a combination of weed and wanting to be a good uncle.
That was my Beatles on Ed Sullivan moment when you guys played on that. Like, I remember everyone at school was watching that SNL episode, and it was just it was such like a huge, crazy thing to kind of, you know, see and get to watch on TV. And now going back, and at the time I thought it was like a deliberate lyric shift, and then now going back, you can see Gord kind of grimace as soon as he says it, and I know what it's to be a vocalist, not on that stage, but on any stage, when you say something, you're like, oh fuck, I can't believe I screwed that up.
Yeah, I remember seeing that too. It's pretty obvious. He's like, what did I just say? And another note about playing Saturday Night Live, we thought it went well. We knew, you know, there were excited people back home watching it. We went to the party after, which lasted about 3 a.m, and our road manager, Dave Powell, may he rest in peace, was making out with one of the girl cast members. But then we had to go on the bus because we were playing St. Louis. So we drove to St. Louis, you know, oh my God, Saturday Night Live, we did it. And to play a club called, I think it's called The Other World. And 10 people there. Like, it changed nothing. You know, it's like, oh, right. We're on this run. St. Louis wasn't, you know, we'd played there maybe once. So we had not developed a crowd yet there, but it was a good kind of wake up call. Just be like, okay, yeah, back to normal, everybody.
I remember talking to the guys from Lex on Fire, or George was telling me from Lex on Fire that they played like the Junos one night, and then same thing, went to America the next day and played to like 25 people, 10 people in a club. And that's what we got.
Being a band, it's not for the faint of heart. You know, I mean, you're everyone. And fortunately, I think that includes everyone. Like even the icons were, we've mentioned, you know, these career bands that you're just like, wow. They all had shit gigs. They all had, and you got to play them. You know, you got to learn how to play on a Tuesday night when there's 14 people there, or maybe four, maybe 40. But everyone's got that. So you have, there's got to be some way to be able to handle it. So you can either, we handled it by we got along really well and we laughed and, you know, we were in it together regardless. And then other people, maybe it's not as ideal. And certainly, especially your singers have, if they don't have that kind of support, you're not getting much from the audience because there's hardly anyone there. It's a difficult life when you're on the road, you know. So, it's not for the faint of heart. That's for sure. Just stay happy and have fun.
The best piece of advice Gord gave me was that lead singers are going to wear it differently than anyone else in the band. And because of that, you'll experience this thing differently than people in your band. And it's true, because you get the highs, but you also get the lows of that. Anyway, I could ramble on to you forever, Paul. Anytime you want to come back on this show, you are always welcome.
Damien, thank you very much. It's excellent talking to you. Sorry I got to run out, but I do have to meet a guy at 2:30. Not for weed. Let's be clear.
If you're a podcast host, listen up. This one's for you. My name is Allie Jackson. I'm the host of Finding Mr. Height, a dating and relationship podcast that I've been doing for 4 years now, sharing my positive and practical approach to dating that's built on my own life experience. And I wanted to share another experience that I've had, my secret behind monetizing my show. It's called Red Circle. And I was just telling my colleague about how much I love their platform. With Red Circle, not only am I getting a seamless hosting experience, but I also love the support I receive in ad sales. It's not just typical ad sales either. It's targeted targeted opportunities based on my show and my life. And the platform is super simple. You just set your preferences and Red Circle matches you with sponsors that align with your show. You can vet every opportunity and their platform gives you great analytics. More recently too, my Red Circle team has brought me opportunities outside of my podcast on social media to really augment the podcast partnerships, bring them full circle. I just can't recommend them enough. If you want to give it a try, go to redcircle.com to get your free trial. That's redcircle.com for a free trial. If you're a podcast host, listen up, this one's for you. My name is Allie Jackson. I'm the host of Finding Mr. Height, a dating and relationship podcast that I've been doing for 4 years now, sharing my positive and practical approach to dating that's built on my own life experience. And I wanted to share another experience that I've had, my secret behind monetizing my show. It's called Red Circle. And I was just telling my colleague about how much I love their platform. With Red Circle, not only am I getting a seamless hosting experience, but I also love the support I receive in ad sales. It's not just typical ad sales either. It's targeted opportunities based on my show and my life. And the platform is super simple. You just set your preferences and Red Circle matches you with sponsors that align with your show. You can vet every opportunity and their platform gives you great analytics. More recently too, my Red Circle team has brought me opportunities outside of my podcast on social media to really augment the podcast partnerships, bring them full circle. I just can't recommend them enough. If you want to give it a try, go to redcircle.com to get your free trial. That's redcircle.com for a free trial.